The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
Well, our next guest has a new book out today called Bad News: Why We Fall for Fake News. He's a psychologist and academic currently living in New York, and he's written previously about conspiracy theories. Rob Brotherton, thank you very much for taking the time to join us here on The Last Word at Today FM. But can I ask you, when we're talking about fake news in the 21st century, to go back and tell me a famous story of fake news from the 20th century, not quite 100 years ago, but not that far off it, involving Orson Welles, please.
Sure. I start the book with the story of Orson Welles's The War of the Worlds, his very famous radio show from the 1930s, in which he retold the old sci-fi story of alien invasion, the H.G. Wells story. But he framed his radio show as if it were a breaking news broadcast. So it was styled as if it was a regular radio show, a music show, and then it was interrupted with these news alerts of an alien invasion on the east coast of America. And the story that basically everybody knows, if you know anything about that radio show, is that it caused mass panic in America, that people tuned their radios in, they heard this apparent breaking news of an invasion, and they freaked out. Basically, there was mass panic, national panic across America. And so I thought that would be an interesting example of fake news to look into for the book. But I discovered pretty quickly that there's a large element of myth about that story, that basically the mass panic didn't happen. And a lot of the research for this was done by a historian at Princeton called Brad Schwartz, and he has an excellent book called Broadcast Hysteria about this. Basically, he looked into the archives of letters that were sent to Orson Welles, to the FCC, to CBS, the broadcaster, by listeners after the radio show. And he was looking for evidence of mass panic, and he couldn't find any, hardly. There was no national panic on a mass scale. There were a few isolated instances of people getting freaked out. But the day after the radio show, newspaper front pages across America said, "Nation panics." And that basically is a myth.
So that was the fake news, rather than the actual rather than the program itself, which was a drama and was probably understood by the vast majority of listeners to be a drama. It was the newspaper coverage the following day, which was the reality of the fake news.
Exactly right. That's what I think is so fascinating about this, is it's a fake news story about fake news. And so I think this is so interesting and illustrative for what we're living through today. Now, fake news has become this fashionable term and people are understandably worried about it. But I think there's an element of over-caution, of thinking that everybody else is falling for fake news, when in fact maybe they're not. Or maybe the problem isn't as extensive as it seems. And maybe there's an element of psychology behind it, and particularly not trusting other people to be as critical consumers of the news as we see ourselves as.
The people who shout fake news in the 21st century, the most, I suppose, dominant figure being President Donald Trump in the United States. When he starts shouting fake news at journalists and press conferences, or goes on Twitter alleging that, do you think, does he believed by many people, or is it majority of people just look at it and say, well, that's just him shouting off propaganda, whatever?
Yeah, it's certainly become a convenient label. It's used by many people, not least of which President Donald Trump, to cast aspersions on basically any information which is unpalatable, which you want to dismiss or cast doubt upon. And so that makes it a difficult thing to study. Partly just by attaching a term like that to a certain kind of information, it implies that it is this concrete thing, that there is some kind of black and white distinction between real news and fake news. And again, very quickly, when I started writing and researching for this book, I realized that there just isn't a clear-cut definition. There's no clear distinction between real news and fake news. And in fact, according to a lot of the public opinion surveys, when you ask people, what are you worried about in terms of the news ecosystem, they'll point to fake news, outright made up, falsified stories. But they're also just as concerned about things like sensationalism, misrepresentation, the kind of routine bad news that we're dealing with all day, every day. And so the story that this book became about was not so much fake news as this small, seemingly concrete niche within the news ecosystem, but much more broadly about how the news industry functions in general.
So is Trump actually cleverly picking on something that there is a belief in society that what has now become known in some circles as mainstream media lies and exaggerates and can't be trusted? So he plays upon that.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems like kind of a savvy strategy if you want people to not trust the media. But it's worth saying that from a historical perspective, this is not new. You know, people talk about a crisis of confidence in the media, this new lack of trust across the board in institutions. But as far as news, as far as the media goes, trust has never really been that high.
Never has been. But is it not worse now in the social media era? Whereas previously you would have had people complaining to newspapers, sending in letters to the editor in multicolored green, red, black and blue writing on a page, that now suddenly they can take to social media with no filter and they can give vent to what they feel. And there seems to be a large number of them who then get picked up by other people who don't believe in what they've been told by traditional established media.
Yeah, I mean, interacting with the media in that sense, as you mentioned, it's not new. People always have interacted. They've wanted to make their voices heard. And so people wrote a lot of letters, as they did to Orson Welles and the FCC and the broadcaster after that radio show. People did routinely. They wanted to participate as the audience, not just to be consumers. And so, yeah, as you say, social media has made that easier. You don't have to pick up a paper and pencil and mail a letter. You can just log on to Twitter or Facebook and make your opinions known. But it's not clear from the research how fundamental of a shift that is versus just a new technological outlet for people to engage in the way that they always have done.
So how can media channels, be it radio, television, newspapers, internet, that are run by old newspapers, what do they need to do to regain confidence of the public and to eliminate the charge that they're involved in the dissemination of fake news?
Well, this is kind of the biggest, most difficult question, and it's been dogging the news industry from the very start when papers began publishing news on a regular schedule. You know, the problem was that if you're putting out a paper once a week or every other day or every day, you have to fill the pages. And so critics at the time realized this is going to change the definition of news. If you have to fill a certain quota, then it lowers the bar. You know, things are going to become newsworthy that wouldn't if you didn't have to publish a paper today. And on the other hand, it kind of flattens the importance of everything. You know, the newspaper takes up roughly a set number of pages every day. And so the most important events and the relatively less important events, they all kind of appear the same. And so, again, this is an ongoing issue that people, audiences and critics and producers have been very aware of. And maintaining the audience's trust is a difficult thing. You know, I think what became clear to me from writing, researching this book was that just more openness and transparency potentially could go a long way. And again, I'm not the first person to say this. News industry insiders have been saying this for a long time. There's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who brought up the New York Times slogan, "All the news that's fit to print." And he wasn't just picking on the New York Times, but he used this as an illustration. He said, you know, that sounds so... It's a good motto, right? All the news that's fit to print. It sounds like you're getting the real story. Everything you need to know is going to be in here. But if publishers were really being more honest about it, they would say it's not all the news that's fit to print. It's just some of the things that happened to cross our desk in the last 24 hours. We thought they were worth printing. We tried our best to make sure they're accurate, but doubtless we're going to get some things wrong, and we'll do our best to correct it tomorrow. So I think that kind of intellectual honesty and humility could go a long way towards maintaining the audience's trust.
Rob, and I say this as somebody who, before I came to this job, has spent 6 years as a newspaper editor. You could probably fill a paper very easily each day and each Sunday with material that is very accurate, and there's plenty of it out there. But a lot of the time, what the readers seem to be looking for is not necessarily simple accuracy and facts, but they want to be entertained and also be provoked by what they're actually reading. So they're looking for a degree of colour and controversy as well. So isn't that something that actually has to be given to them, or else they simply won't consume what's put in front of them?
Well, that's certainly right. And, you know, I certainly don't want to give the impression that all the blame should be heaped on the news producers, the editors and journalists and so on. You know, that has been one sort of strand of attack with news criticism, is just pinning the blame on journalists and editors, saying they're, you know, cynical and they just want to put out this bad information and attack other people. But of course, I think that's only, well, that's not the full equation. We have to look at the role of the audience, the consumer, what they want to consume. And so I think you're absolutely right. You know, as the audience, the reason why news sells is because it gives us something that we're looking for. And you're absolutely right. Oftentimes that's not just raw information, but it's entertainment. It's not every important story, but it's certain kinds of stories. And so I think the question you're actually asking is, is there a responsibility or a business necessity to give the audiences that? I'm not qualified to answer that. I think you certainly would be better than me. My approach with this book was just to take a historical and psychological perspective and try and unravel this question of, you know, what is the state of trust in the news industry and why is it low and why do consumers keep going back to it despite the ongoing questions and criticism?
One final one to you, Rob Brotherton. As I mentioned earlier, before this book, Bad News, Why We Fall for Fake News, you've previously written about conspiracy theories. There's one that's very prevalent internationally at present and which has certainly reared its head here in Ireland as well. That's about 5G mobile phone telephony and the masks, and as to whether it actually creates illness, even spreading COVID-19. But isn't it the case that certainly that sort of conspiracy is not spread by mainstream media, but is by the likes of your Facebooks and Twitters and Instagram? What about their responsibility for spreading fake news and conspiracy theories rather than focusing on the older traditional media?
Yeah, this is a tricky question, I think. Obviously, there often are these conspiracy theories and misinformation that circulate online, and they can have quite large audiences. But a question that underlies that is, what does it mean if somebody comes across that information, or if they engage with it, if they click on it and read it or share it online? Does that mean that they believe it and are being influenced by it? Does it mean that they're just entertaining it in some sense? Maybe they're sharing it just to troll, to get a laugh or to get a reaction out of people. Maybe they're trying to signal something broader about the world. Maybe it's not about the 5G or the virus. Maybe it's just signaling that, you know, I don't always trust what I'm being told here. And I think conspiracy theories may often serve that function, not of signaling our true literal beliefs, but of signaling our broader worldview. And so I think it's a difficult question whether social media networks should be responsible for controlling, censoring that kind of information. I think the role of the mainstream media is complicated too. You know, again, you're better placed, I think, to really answer these questions than me about the responsibility of covering news. But I think it's worth thinking about whether those kind of bad ideas should be amplified by the mainstream media, especially with an ongoing event like this, with the 5G conspiracy theories during, you know, a pandemic like this. We don't know how many people believe these theories. We don't know how many people are engaging with them. And so what is the responsibility of the media in terms of amplifying these theories and giving potentially the impression that they're much more widespread than they are, bringing them to a new audience who might not have been coming across them online.
We have to leave it there. It's fascinating stuff. It's Bad News, Why We Fall for Fake News. Rob Brotherson, thank you very much for joining us here on The Last Word at Today FM.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live, on air, from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.